This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Joining us this morning for today's call-in show, Neil Milner, political analyst and contributing editor of our segment, The Long View, and Chad Blair, political and opinion editor for Honolulu Civil Beat. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Catherine.
Thank you.
So before we check out the local scene, we want you to weigh in on what's happening nationally, since that's obviously the big story on, you know, the Democrats taking back the House.
Well, it's a bit of a moving target in the Senate. Certainly the Republicans are going to pick up some seats, but there's Bill Nelson in Florida, who appears to be not conceding to Rick Scott in that race, even though it looks like Scott prevailed. There's the race in Arizona between Sinema, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, and McSally. That race has yet to be called. I think there may be another outstanding race as well, and so one wonders how those final numbers are going to shake out. Clearly it was a big night for the House. I was particularly struck by the fact that, boy, something like a record number of women elected, and in all likelihood, Nancy Pelosi returning as Speaker.
Well, we'll see about Nancy Pelosi returning, because that's as much about the dynamics, the internal dynamics of the new people. I think you also have to keep in mind what was very normal about this election, and using Trump and normal in the same sentence isn't a very common sort of thing. But first of all, the amount of seats that the Democrats picked up in the House, if you would put a generic Republican candidate in with the same, or a generic president with the same approval rating, generally they would pick up, the opposing party would pick up about the same amount. So that really fell right into that kind of thing. The Senate, the Republicans did pretty well in the Senate, but again, only for very fundamental kind of reasons, because there were very few contested Republican seats. So that was all pretty normal. What's very different is that there was a movement to the left, for sure, 10% on the average in the average congressional district. Secondly, is that there were some changes, some important changes in governorships in states that Trump really needed to win in 2016 in order to win, and not just governorships. Wisconsin turned from Republican to Democrat and governor, Michigan, and so on.
Illinois, too,
although Illinois wasn't one of the swing states.
Right.
But that's right. Yeah, Illinois. In Pennsylvania, the Democrats did very well in the congressional election. But the big thing was, in fact, the increase in turnout, including youth turnout. But everything else was pretty much along the lines that you would expect. The people that were getting a lot of attention because they might pull an upset probably didn't pull the upset. And then on the other hand, there's a few places like the congressional race in Oklahoma City that nobody expected to go from red to blue, and it did, and including some other places in Kansas, which was arguably they had the most conservative politicians in the country. There was even some switches there.
This is the state where a former MMA fighter, and I believe she's a Native American as
yeah,
well,
yeah.
Was elected in Kansas, the reddest of state. And, of course, in the governor turn with Chris Klobuchar, a strong supporter of the president, strong anti-immigration, and yet they elect a Democrat.
Yes,
a woman.
They did. Klobuchar has a number of problems that have less to do with just his ideology.
Putting it mildly,
but you're right. I mean, that's a very red state that turned a little bit.
And I know there was a lot of talk early on about, oh, this blue wave, which some said, well, really didn't happen. We lost some seats, I think, in the Senate, right? So
right now, it's the Democrats lost three, the Republicans picking those up. But as I said, there's at least two that are not quite settled yet. We'll find out. But that was a good call for McConnell in that House, in the Senate. Remember, Trump actively campaigned for the Senate seats. He went to Montana how many times?
Yeah, times.
It didn't work.
Florida.
John Tester stayed, but he went to Indiana. It worked there. Joe Donnelly was beat by Mike Braun. So I think the president wisely picked his battles there, stayed away, or was asked to stay away from a number of House districts.
What did you think of the president's news conference this morning?
Surreal. You know, one's running out of adjectives to describe the press conferences and the behavior of the president. He started to spin it as a good night for Republicans, somehow ignoring that the House fell and the House will have subpoena power. Who knows what they're going to do in terms of investigations. But gradually you could see he was getting into it with the reporters, going against Acosta of CNN, using that phrase, enemy of the people. And if I heard correctly, at one point saying he would be investigating the House. should they somehow start investigating him, which probably is going to happen, his tax returns, we'll see. But it was, he certainly was not a unifier. I know when George Bush saw the midterms go badly, I saw, same with Barack Obama, you saw them recognizing and saying, look, we lost pretty badly. We'll try and work together. Not the case with the president.
Well, the president did at one point, though, say that, you know, he's going to be working with Nancy Pelosi and we work together well and maybe we'll find some common ground.
Sure. Look, the president could have and probably had written that speech, at least in his head, well in advance of the results, because he would have given the same kind of speech, maybe the same words, with the same result regardless of it, because that's how he thinks. And it should be a reminder about two fundamental things about Trump, one of which is don't pay attention to all this fluff about what he's saying about Pelosi or not. He fundamentally doesn't change. And secondly, which is less indirect but is also important, that does not necessarily hurt him at all. So when Chad and I sit there and think, this is a surreal speech, who does this? You know, but we can't follow that by saying, and it's going to work against them, because it almost never does. Mm-hmm. I've just been reading some stuff, a reassessment of the 2016 campaign, and it's astonishing how little those things had impact for very long. All those things that especially the progressives and the women said, that's it, we're finally going to get them now, the country's going to turn. That's not there. So you have to see what he says and the way in the context of how he thinks, and you have to think of the results of that in terms of what the usual results are.
I do want to just add, Trump has to know that two of his biggest policy goals are not going to happen. He's not going to get funding for a wall on the southern border. It's not going to happen in this House. And he's not going to get a repeal of Obamacare, which the House repeatedly voted for under Republican control. Those are big blows to the president's agenda, and he's going to have to fight on other things. There's going to be no compromise with Democratic leaders on those issues.
No, and although he has been effective from his standpoint in chipping away at Obamacare, and the executive still has a lot of room. The devil is in the details on some of the Obamacare stuff.
I know when Senator Brian Schatz was in here in our studios, he had talked about, you know, what the message was, and they weren't going to, you know, go away from the message about health care and what this means. What do you folks think this win in the House means for Hawaii?
Well, that's I'm still kind of getting over the fact that Ed Case is going back to Congress. I mean, it's been since 2006, and the world has changed, and I'd just be fascinated to see what goes through his mind. It's going to help Hawaii. Pelosi has a close association with Hawaii, not only geographically, because we're close that way, but I think it's going to help us in a number of ways. It's been a while since we've been in the majority, and all our delegation, the entire delegation, is Democrat, and so I think that it's going to help us tremendously, but you know, I don't know that it's going to change all that remarkably overnight in terms of the day-to-day, the appropriations. Probably will stay pretty steady.
Well, I know when we were covering, and I've just blanked out.
No, that's
Case,
all right.
Case, when he sure. was with, at the state legislature, one criticism was, oh, he's really a Republican in Democratic clothing.
Neil, what do you think about that one?
I think that that's more fluff than reality. If you looked at it, never mind the state legislature, it's hard to read the state legislature since even during that period, everybody's a Democrat. And if they're conservative or liberal or not, it's so non-transparent that you have to kind of guess. I think that when he was in Congress, he was to the left of center. He was to the right somewhat of Neil and someone else in there. But he's not exactly, and he's certainly not a he's certainly not a Republican-leaning person. Now, one of the things that he chose to do then that would occasionally trouble people here, the Democratic stalwarts here, was that he associated with the Blue Dog Democrats, who were the centrists, okay? Right now, being a centrist is wishful thinking. There are some caucuses because there's not any guys like Case are going to have a very different Congress than they did before.
There's no more Blue Dogs.
There's no more Blue Dogs, but there are some other reform Congresses. And I happened to run into him the other day and ask him about this. And he says, I'm actually affiliated with one of those. He still has that kind of sentiment. I think in his case, it's real rather than the usual kind of bipartisanship. I'll work on both sides of the aisle and then it disappears. But I think it's going to be tremendously hard to be a centrist because they don't have any power because when you're so polarized, you can't really offer either side very much if you're a centrist.
And then just the fact that you've got the Democrats in control of the House, do you think that's also going to bode well for Hawaii?
Well, it can't hurt. I guess it's hard. Just thinking about Hawaii, there might be some small things. I mean, one of the good things that our legislators have done in the past, certainly when we had our late senior senator, is they could get things for here. I think that's likely. The trouble is that politics has become national, and so the agendas become national, and the way people see things, including legislators, is through national issues. That's a kind of barrier to Hawaii because much of what Hawaii is about is its special place. I don't mean an emotionally special place. It's different. It has some different needs. And we've in the past been able to capitalize that on a bit. But that's going to be – that gets increasingly harder as time goes on.
All right. And if you're just joining us, we have Neil Milner, political analyst and contributing editor in studio with us, and Chad Blair from Honolulu Civil Beat. We do have some reaction from Governor David Ige on his win last night. Let's take a listen.
You know, this journey started a long time ago, 5 years ago. And I see so many familiar faces who have been with us, with Don and I, and the Ige family every step of that way. So I really want to thank all of you, the hundreds and hundreds of volunteers statewide that really makes successful campaigns happen. So thank you from the Ige family to all of you.
Any reaction as to what lies ahead?
Chicken skin. I mean, he was clearly welling up. He was in tears. It was quite a moment. Perhaps his last election. I don't see him running for the U.S. Senate. I think his biggest challenge, while he does have a mandate, I mean, he beat Colleen Honabus in the primary by 6 or 7 points. It was a landslide over Tupola in the general election. The problem is the leaders of the State House and Senate openly supported Hanabusa, raised money for her. I'm talking specifically about Ron Cochi, the Senate president, Scott Psyche, the House Speaker, others in the top leadership, in the membership, and they're going to have to find a way to work together. It's ironic. They belong to the same party. There's no minority party really to speak of. And by the way, a correction earlier, they didn't really pick up a seat in the House. They actually just kept the five they had. They did win in Mililani, but remember, there was no Republican to replace Tupola. She was disqualified, Sai Timoteo, because of the Samoan registration. But I think that's going to be the biggest challenge. Will the House and Senate leadership welcome the governor, who will come in with a new 2-year budget in December, who will have all sorts of ideas, and will they give him some credit? Will they honor his mandate? I think there's going to be tension there.
I think that the biggest challenge that he has, in addition to what Chad said, is the biggest challenge that governors always have in this state, and the one that they usually don't do very well in, and that is reforming the kind of bureaucratic culture that the state has, a sort of risk-averse, very, even by bureaucratic standards, very locked in, and so on. When Ige first ran for office, he prided himself, and he advertised himself this way, as a Mr. Fix-It, and that some of the basic problems of the state, that the nuts and bolts stuff that are very important, like fixing the way that the tax department works and so on, and IT getting better, those things remain just about as stubborn as ever. Department of Transportation issues with how the airports run. That's a daunting task. I've been a bit disappointed in his – I know what a challenge is. I've been a bit disappointed that he hasn't been much better than anybody else doing that. But that's a constant issue. When people talk cynically about Hawaii politics, that's the story they told. And it's easy to say that about bureaucracies, and there are many good people in the bureaucracies, but I think we have such a pervasive, risk-averse kind of operation here, and so many structural – impediments that never get overcome. Just look at the state auditing reports, the state audit reports sometimes, that's a challenge, and I don't know if anybody's up to it.
And there are some big issues ahead. You know, there's obviously the over-tourism issue, and, you know, how do we deal with that? There are issues with the modernization of our tax department.
Well, TMT is going to be very interesting because he was kind of lucky on the iteration of the TMT conflict, the 30-meter telescope, during the last time, because he was talking tough, saying, you know, if we're going to go through with this and I'll enforce the law. But then the fact that there was a contested case hearing, which put it back into, let's say, the justice area. Technically,
judiciary,
it's not
right.
The judiciary. It's really not a court case, although then it became one. Took it off the table. But now, if it's going to go ahead, and he started to say that I'll enforce the law, he's going to have two issues quite possibly on his plate, one of which is how do you deal with civil disobedience? Are you really going to enforce it? And the other one, and that's a tough one for anybody, the other one, which he's not particularly good at, is becoming using the bully pulpit. That is, if you get into a situation of protest, you as a governor are going to want to use your ability to get people, the public, to side with you. He's never really had to do that. That's a hard job for anybody. That's not his strength.
What about you, Chad? What do you think are his big challenges are going to be as far as issues?
Homelessness. While there has been progress, at least according to the point in time count, I think you have to give the governor some credit. The numbers have gone down. We'll see what happens when the next report comes out. But talk about risk adverse. Here's an idea that the legislature had, which is out of the box thinking. Safe zones or Ohana zones, and they've allocated $30 million to build six of those on the islands, the major islands. And that's a pretty remarkable development for the legislature to move forward on something like that. The governor is actually against it, his own homeless coordinator, Scott Morishige. They have resisted this idea. They say it really doesn't fundamentally solve the problem of homelessness, which is really getting people under permanent housing, getting them the social services they need. Well, the last I checked, the governor, have you seen any safe zones popping up? I mean, this
no.
thing was
just
bad.
The one that Dwayne Carrizo built.
But that's a different situation.
Yeah,
exactly.
Right. Yeah.
And so there's another example of whether he's going to be able to work with the legislature to follow through on this, and an issue that he will remain vulnerable. I do agree with Neil. He's not able to articulate a vision very well. He's still not a very good speaker, although I think he got better.
Yeah.
He definitely upped his game with Hanabusa, and you saw a different David Ige. Whether he can then translate that into a state of the state address that uplifts people and moves them forward, that's really going to be a test.
There's also the education piece.
Oh, yeah.
The Con Am.
I mean, he supported the Con Am. Mm-hmm. Of course, he's known for his position on education. His wife, Dawn, an educator, very much involved, concerns with the Board of Education. And yet the Con Am failed. And we even saw what the vote was. Even though he couldn't vote for it, it still lost.
Many more votes than what Tupola got for our governor.
Right. But, you know, he got the backing of the HSTA, Corey Rosenlee. And the dollar figure that was cited was anywhere from $200 to $400 million. Being short, maybe even as much as $1 billion. This is a budget that's already $2 billion for the DOE, and everyone agreed, even the opponents coming out of it, gee, we really would like to help schools. Well, what are you going to do? Yeah. Are you going to raise the GET for that? Are you going to take money from elsewhere? That's going to be a big challenge.
Well, when I first read that amendment, my first thought, cynic that I can be, is
you?
This is the yeah, really surprising. Yeah, that this is the way that the legislature is trying to default on their responsibilities for education. You know, you're a legislative body. Something is in need. You figure out how to get money for it. You can pass and I'm going to use the word here, tax increase, which in a sense is what this is, but it's indirect. The legislature really didn't have any direct responsibility in here. So now we're back to the fact that if you really want to give more money to the teachers and you think it's not just inefficiency in the DOE bureaucracy, you're back to the traditional ways of doing it, which is finding the revenue through taxes.
Or taking it from somewhere else.
Or taking it from somewhere else. Sure, both of those, particularly the tax one, are things that even the most liberal legislators don't like to do because you call it a tax. Nothing in this thing was exactly called a tax.
In fact, that was part of the legal challenge.
Yeah.
It's a surcharge. Well, what's a surcharge?
Surcharge. Yeah.
It's a tax.
That's a term you use in Monopoly, right? In playing the game Monopoly, surcharge.
It's a three-letter, four-letter word.
Yeah.
Okay, anything else you think as far as challenges for the governor in this last term?
Well, it is a fresh start. It is a clean slate. And already the legislative leaders, nothing really changed in the House and Senate. They're already putting together their agenda, their bills. There will be a vote on leadership, and you will have settlements on who's going to run the committees and whatnot. I do wonder whether there will be an unexpected thing. Remember, it's a non-election year. Say what you will about the legislature, which is its popular opinion numbers are actually below Trump, according to the University of Hawaii study. Caldwell and Ige don't do very well either. But I do give the legislature credit in 2018 for actually being fairly progressive. And the biggest case would be medical aid in dying. That's something that went nowhere forever. And then suddenly it finally came through. And there were a number of other things they did in terms of the environment that were pretty remarkable. Remember banning oxybenzone to help, at least when you sell it here. You can still bring it in your sunscreen tubes, but you can't have it here. There are a number of other things as well. I wonder if there might be some surprise legislation that might embolden them. Scott Psyche, in particular, has said that he wants to see the House be a unit of change, an organ that can actually enact change. Our legislature is not really known for that.
Do you think there's going to be issues as far as the recovery on the Big Island?
You know, the recovery on the Big Island up to now has been as close to a model of efficient government that I've seen. I mean, I think that the disaster response, the fact that you're dealing with multiple agencies at different levels of government has been going pretty well. You know, recovery is such a complex and deep sort of emotional thing. You almost have to ask the people there if you think so. But I think the sides have been good. Let me give you three quick challenges that I think he faces, two of which could possibly involve potential lawsuits. One is whether the new forensic-oriented mental health facility, the mental hospital, is actually that's far enough along, whether that's actually built. We've needed that for a long time. If they don't do something about it, there's a good chance that there'd be an ACLU suit. Another one, which is not nearly at this stage yet, is the prison. For years, we've been kind of trying to finesse the prison issue. OCCC is crowded. Ige has some other very interesting ideas about how to use that land for transit-oriented development. But to make the next move into saying we're going to build a prison, because there's dissensus about even the prison. The third one is always one of my favorites to kick down the line, the so-called new stadium. Now, no one is going to force them to build it. The ACLU is not going to sue them. But the stadium is like, for sports fans here, I don't know, the fountain of youth, that if we're going to build a new football stadium and they have plans to develop the land and so on, I think those things are going to be around for a while, especially the first two. But the stadium one will come back, too.
Okay. Well, this is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. We're talking about the election results, and you can join the discussion by calling 1-877-941-3689. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break, and we'll take a look at the Neighbor Island races.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Barry Hyman and Alice McDermott of FIM Group, an independent firm providing wealth planning and investment management since 1984 and serving Maui clients for more than 20 years.
I'm Marco Werman. On the day after edition of The World, we're in Arizona, Georgia, and Minnesota, where race and ethnicity factored big in the campaigns. Elections with a record number of women candidates, a tug of war over what it means to be an American, and a fight over issues that feel local but are global, from trade to migration to climate change. Unpacking America's choices on The World.
He also does.
This afternoon at 1.
We are back here at the Conversation Studios, and we're going to go off to talk to Dick Mayer. He's a Maui political analyst and retired University of Hawaii Maui College economics and geography professor. Here's what he had to say about the races last night.
The election on Maui this year, 2018, created a bit of a revolution. There's been a major shift here on Maui, not at the mayor's level, but at the county council. At the mayor's level, Mike Victorino, longtime council member and well-known personality on Maui because of his son's baseball playing, won the mayor's race against Ellie Cochran. He won by about 5,000 votes and will be our new mayor for a four-year term. At the county council is where the real changes took place, and it's been a sea change. There were four open seats. Several new candidates came in, and they were endorsed by a coalition called the Ohana Coalition, or the Maui Pono Network. and they took over the council. And this was, I think, a major change. Also, several of the incumbent council members were defeated. In Kahului, major surprise, I think, to many, many people, Alan Arakawa, our present mayor and has been a mayor on Maui now for 12 years off and on, lost out to Pastor Natalie Tashakama. And it was a major upset for the mayor, and I'm sure that will be the talk of the town now that he lost by over by about 11,000 votes. Kelly King, the present incumbent in South Maui, won easily by almost 20,000 votes and will continue on. And my guess is that she very likely will be the new county council chair. She's the top vote-getter on the island. The change at the county council is that there are now five members of what was referred to as the Ohana Coalition candidates have now taken majority control of the council, and that's the revolution on Maui. For a long time, established business interests and developers seem to have control of the council. It seems that now there'll be a change, and the implications are interesting. The new mayor, Mr. Victorino, will have to have all his appointments to department heads and all his appointments to boards and commissions have to go through the council, where the five-vote Ohana Coalition group could potentially veto his recommendations or create difficulties for him, and so he'll have to play ball with them on his nominations for the various boards and commissions.
That was Dick Mayer, political analyst on the Maui Island. Any thoughts about what happened there on Maui?
I tell you, Alan Arakawa did not see that one coming. It's really quite remarkable, first of all, for a mayor to run for council, to go down lower, if you will, in terms of office. But I wonder how much it hurt his case that he was going to run for lieutenant governor. And he bragged that he and Bernard Carvalho would be running mates, that Carvalho would run for governor. And he dithered back and forth, and I heard that Bernard was not so happy that that was announced like that, even though they are mayors of the counties. And I think he's also been hurt by some of the infighting that's been going on there. But to lose by that margin is really quite remarkable. It has to be humiliating for
him. Well, early in the evening, before we really knew much about voting there, but he probably had a good inkling, he did an interview with KITV that was the nastiest interview that a candidate I've ever heard talk about an opposing candidate. Now, he was talking about the person running against Victorino, but he said in a very even-handed way, he said she has a yellow streak down her back, she only has a GED.
Ellie Cochran,
yeah. She's an idiot. I've called her that before, and I'm calling her that again. And if she wins, which she didn't, if she wins, the place was going to fall apart in a year, he said. When you hear something like that, you know that there's something deeply personal going on in addition to that. And I think what Dick said and what you just said, Chad, kind of helps to explain that.
One thing that wasn't mentioned in the report was the charter question on Maui regarding the short-term rentals, and I believe it passed.
Yeah. Yes,
I think that was coming from Mike White on the council, and it really adds a stiff penalty for violations. And really, the Airbnb issue, if you will, has been really more of a county issue than the state issue. The state can't quite see how to deal with this issue. They've really punted on that. But Maui took a big step in terms of penalizing, something like a $10,000 fine, mm-hmm. and then each day it goes up, and wonder whether that will have an effect, particularly in Maui, which is heavily dependent on short-term rentals.
Right, big stick. We do have a call on the line. Jade from Kamauele, you've been very patient. What's on your mind? Jade.
Oh,
Jade,
hi.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm calling from the Big Island of Hawaii, where I was a poll worker in Waimea. We seem to have a steady stream of voters just coming out, just coming in. We had a whole bunch of new voters, as well as absentee and early voting. So we seem to have bucked the trend of the state, but then we joined the mainland and getting our voters to come out and come out and vote. So. Go Broncos.
All right. Well, that must have made you feel very good just to know that you volunteered there and people were receptive and coming in to vote.
Yes. I was a poll worker two years ago in 2016, and we definitely noticed the increase of voters just coming in. So, yeah, very happy about that.
Well, thank you, Jada. I know in my district, when I went in to vote, the folks there were saying, gosh, there was a line of voters waiting to get in to cast their vote.
Imagine that, people wanting to exercise their democratic right.
Well, the line, sometimes the line has to do with the fact that older people are much more likely to vote. They get there first thing in the morning. When I went to my polling place, which was about, I don't know, a little after 9, it was predominantly elderly people that were there. I mean, partly that's about time and who works and who's retired. But I always get, if you go into a polling booth, they tend to tilt gray, as in hair, both in terms of the workers and the voters.
I know I personally like to go out to the polls and cast my vote because I like to, you know, see my neighbors and get a feel for what's happening out there. But I did feel, you know, after voting, you know, thinking, oh, gosh, there's not really anything that jumps out at you. But I felt good after casting my vote.
I would just add, I certainly honor a lot of folks that like to go and turn out. They feel good about doing it. I'm someone who hasn't actually walked into a polling precinct except for work purposes in the last 20 years because I have to work on Election Day. I'm a journalist, and so I've been voting absentee for a very long time now. And I was encouraged to see that the absentee voting still is a majority as opposed to the walk-in, and that trend line is continuing as well. And remember, even if with absentee voting, it still allows you the option to go in and vote in the voting booth.
You know, the data on absentee voting generally is that they don't increase it doesn't increase turnout very much because the same people who voted by going to the ballot box are the ones who are more likely to vote absentee, and so you're not really pulling people who hadn't voted before into it. That's always the interesting thing about voting, that is how much of it is about making it easier to do certain things. Mm. And how much of it is about more basic motivations and more basic lack of interest in voting. And we always hear it's always easier to turn to the little things you can do, which we've started to do pretty well. But that's not anything close to a guarantee that it's going to affect the turnout very much.
In fact, our turnout here in Hawaii, just the second worst is my understanding. 2014, the last governor's race, was the lowest turnout that we've had. So still show a poor turnout in terms of doing our democracy.
You must have seen the chart that was in that very interesting Civil Beat article yesterday, and I was trying to look at it in different ways. It had a chart of the number of people who are registered to vote in midterms from, 1962 until 2010, and the number of people who actually voted. So you know the number of registrations is going to increase because the population increases. But if you look at that chart one way, more people voted in 1980 than voted in 2010, even though we have a much larger population. And the disparity between the number of people who have registered and actually the number of people who have voted has increased enormously, which suggests that registration is just the first part of the battle. You can make it easier to get people to register, but that hasn't been successful in increasing the turnout.
And this was the first year, I think, where you could just go in, register, and then vote. I'd be curious to see
how many people actually did that.
Right. Yeah. And I know I overheard a conversation from a gentleman who made a mistake, and he was saying, I prefer the machines. I wish we would go back to the machines. But I don't know. Do you think what are the chances are of online voting?
Nil. I just don't think it's going to happen. Although I understand that there is an exception made for some absentee voters in some races, mainline-wise. But I don't see that happening, although it's interesting. We do our banking online. We do any number of things, check our medical records, but we just haven't moved there yet. I don't see that happening. I don't see any push toward
hackable.
That.
Hackable.
Yeah, I think it's hackable. The safest way is kind of the way we do it, optical scanners.
Yeah, so we have a paper trail, but it is a machine that is ultimately reading it. And if you do make a mistake in the ballot booth, you can go and get a new ballot.
Yes.
Okay. All right, and let's turn our attention to the Big Island. Sherry Bracken is our contributing reporter over there, and she had something interesting to say about the races overnight.
So we had some really interesting things happen here on Hawaii Island. State Senate and State House races, results were pretty much as expected. All of the offices went to Democratic candidates. Drew Kanuha is the newly elected senator for West Hawaii, taking the seat vacated by Dr. Josh Green when he set out to run for lieutenant governor. And here's something I did not find out until this morning. the state constitution says the term of a member of the legislature shall begin on the day of the general election. And that means that Drew Kanuha is officially now the state senator for the West Hawaii district, which he holds. That leaves his current council district, County Council 7, empty. That is a Kona district, and that will stay empty until the inauguration on December 3rd. The Hawaii County Council has had one member, Jen Ruggles, who represents Puna, not show up for weeks and weeks because she believes serving on the council is illegal under Hawaiian law. So this means that at this moment there's actually two seats on the nine-member Hawaii County Council that are unfilled. That's going to be interesting for whatever vote comes up at the one meeting they have between now and December 3rd. For most bills, you need five to pass. I think that one of the biggest issues, though, right now, the vacation rental bill is up for another reading on the November 20th meeting. And, you know, that's been a pretty hotly contested bill. So to the point of Rebecca Villegas, that was the only county council race that was contested in this election, and that represents Central Kona. Drew Kanuha has held it for three terms, and Rebecca Shute Villegas ran against Kelly Drysdale. Rebecca got 3,079 votes. Kelly got 2,357 votes.
Interesting developments over there. Do you think this issue of two vacant seats on the council is going to be a problem for them?
I don't think so. It's a sort of a recovery period. It's November. Thanksgiving is coming. I'm glad that Sherry did mention that the vacation rental, again, the county's having to deal with this. I don't know that it's going to be the end of the world. The Jen Ruggles situation is very unique in that she is challenging the legality of the actions of the council based on Hawaiian overthrow and so forth. I'm not even going to go into that right now, but that I don't see it severely hampering anything. But she is right in that it does start on the day of the election for the legislative seats, even though they're not actually officially sworn in by the Supreme Court justice until early in the new year. And yeah, the governor and the LG are not sworn in until early December.
Neil?
No.
No thoughts on
that?
I have
nothing to add. No. I think
okay.
Jan covered it.
All right. Well, let's turn to Kauai. Jan Ten Bruggenkate, he's a former reporter, Kauai bureau chief for the Honolulu Advertiser. Here's his take on the races.
Our mayor's race went pretty much as the primary indicated. Derek Kawakami, who had as many votes in the primary as all the other candidates combined, was up against Mel Raposo, the chairman of our county council, and he soundly defeated Mel. He had 65% of the vote compared to Mel's 30% of the vote. On the county council, we had three incumbents who ran for mayor. Two of them had run to the end of their term because of term limits, and the third was Derek Kawakami, who was the ultimate winner in the mayor's race. But three open seats led to a great deal of interest in the council race. As anticipated, the four incumbents were reelected. The newcomers were interesting. One of them was Kipu Kaikuli, who has served on the council before and was a familiar name. But there are two folks who are first-time holders of public office. One is very good showing, third place, Luke Evslin, who is a canoe club coach. The other new candidate is Felicia Cowden. She's a radio host on a community radio station called KKCR. She's well-known there. And we did have a change at the top. Errol Kaneshiro, who has for the last couple of years led every council election, dropped to second place, and Mason Chalk, who's incumbent on the council in his third term. With a majority of the incumbents coming back, and that majority includes the group that has been in charge of the council for the past couple of years, the suggestion is that there won't be radical changes. We did have several proposed charter amendments. The one that was the biggest slam dunk was a proposal to do away with term limits, which are what opened up the race this year, and the voters of Kauai by 74 to 16% said, no, we like term limits.
Interesting.
And by the way, if I remember correctly, the term limits proposal at the charter level in Kauai was just for the council. I don't believe it included the mayor, if I have that right. But, you know, I found that to be an interesting one. Didn't get a whole lot of attention, term limits on Kauai, eliminating them. Mm-hmm. And remember, all the county councils, all the county mayors are term limited, unlike the legislature.
Right.
And unlike the Congress, which, of course, is set federally. But it's interesting. I believe it was actually a member of the Kauai Council that wanted to change the charter that might have benefited that council member.
Right, and I remember here in Honolulu, yeah. The whole idea with term limits for the mayor was because we had the longest-serving mayor, Frank Fossey, over and over and over again, and folks wanted to get in.
Yeah. Term limits are a funny one. I personally feel like term limits are decided by the voter. That's my personal feeling, but I know many people feel strongly that term limits are necessary. Get rid of, I don't know, corrupt lawmakers, bring in new, fresh blood. There's good arguments on both sides.
Yes.
Now, what about Honolulu? Coming back to Oahu here, our charter amendments, thumbs down on that one.
I don't think anybody understood it.
I think that was it.
I understood it, and even then, we actually editorialized in favor of it, but I think there's such animosity towards HART over this rail project, $9 billion and counting, that voters saw the word HART in the sentence and said, forget it, you know.
That's what I thought immediately.
Right, I think the mayor tried to put a better gloss on it, saying it was just too complicated. But I think Chad's right. You see anything that has HART in it, and if there's any, your immediate mindset is going to be, I don't want to do anything that, in quotation marks, moves this forward because it doesn't move it forward.
It was a housekeeping measure.
It really was.
And it was because the legislature passed that tax bailout last year, and it changed the makeup of HART. And because of that, they had a problem getting enough votes to pass important legislation. And this would have altered how the votes would be counted. It would have made it easier for HART as a board to vote and pass things rather than having to get 8 of the 9.
It's about efficiency.
Yeah, but most people looked it over, and then again, yeah. HART,
well, you know. But giving, you can understand in the eyes of the voters that giving HART a chance to be more efficient is not necessarily a good thing because they might think to become efficient to make it even worse. Yeah. So I think there's a lot. That said, I was sympathetic toward the amendment.
I think it's going to complicate the ability of HART going forward. There was an example earlier this year that reported in which they could not advance some important action because they didn't have enough votes to do so. Somebody was absent. And this was the whole idea was to make it easier to do that, and that's not going to be the case.
Right, and that is frustrating because I've been at those meetings when they said we're going to lose quorum. We have to decide on this. And it's important stuff and the most difficult route of the rail. So that could cause problems, but then we just have to, I think, make the folks that are on the board more accountable. Yeah. You're going to be at this meeting, and why aren't you going to be at this meeting? And
it's an unpaid gig, by the way, but I think ultimately it's the people that appoint them. And in this case, one thing that also came out of the state legislature bailout is more oversight by the state government. And so you have the House Speaker appointing someone, the Senate President, and the HART charter actually would have had the council name another member as well, if I understood correctly.
No, the state figured if we're such a big stakeholder in it, plus the fact they don't trust the mayor, we're going to do as much. And that's where that auditing procedure comes from.
Yeah.
Although it's interesting when you start thinking about all these little things, when the big thing is we're not sure we can even pay for the next half of it, which is going to be logistically more complicated than the first half. We're still there. We're still a federal agency whose job it is to give away money. I mean, this is a department. This is what they do. Has bent over backwards to give HART an opportunity to get the money, and they still can't make this thing. And that's, I guess, the recent $44 million thing puts us a little bit closer. But it's still far from definitive that they're going to accept this recent iteration about, you know, to give us the money to build that.
And at stake is at least $750 million, because $1.5 billion is the total the FTA has allocated.
Right, and the FTA, Federal Transit Authority, who holds that purse string.
The plan does build into it. I'm not surprised. a certain amount of money unstated for legal settlements for lawsuits because they have an ongoing lawsuit for $100 million, $200 million with Ansaldo.
Ansaldo. Yeah. Right.
Now, they're not saying how much they put aside because that's bad negotiating.
Right, right. Yeah.
But that's there.
Even though it's our money.
Yeah, well, I know.
Since we're talking about the mayor and the council, let's look at some races because last night it was like deja vu again with East Honolulu.
I went to bed thinking that Tommy Waters was the new council member, and I woke up and found out it was Trevor Ozawa. And correct me if I'm wrong, was it 22 votes?
Yes,
is that
I believe
22?
It was.
Well, the good news is that Waters cut into the lead from last time. Wasn't it 40-something?
40-something,
yes. And you have the lead.
And I don't know what kind of challenge there may be over that. You have to feel tough for Tommy, who had this very difficult thing just 4 years ago. And Trevor has to just be waking up and going, what on earth is going on? I mean, did they even go to bed? Who knows? Because that final printout came out, I don't know what time.
I don't know. Is it a printout? I mean, we didn't even
it is.
It
is.
Okay. It's some kind of miscellaneous
a fifth stuff. And yeah. final printout comes out around 2 or 3 in the morning. And this is the final count, and that's where it shifted in terms of the numbers for Trevor and Tommy.
I'm told that the final one came at 4 a.m.
Oh, it was 4 a.m.
And those aren't standard because it was 17 out of 17 precincts or whatever.
It is actually – this happens – it is standard that there is always a fifth one that comes out. It's usually, as I understand it, the straggling – absentee ballots. It's not
yes.
from the precincts. It's but it involves a lot of ballots still coming in on Oahu in this case.
And I know East Honolulu is my district, and so I've been watching the battles at the at the intersections. You know, because every day they're at it, and even up to the last day when I went in to vote, there was a Waters camp on one side and the Trevor Ozawa camp on the other. So
and Waters is believed to be aligned with Kirk Caldwell because of their past legislative history, and of course Ray. Is a fundamental dividing point on the council.
Yeah, I have to admit, when I went to bed, I was wondering, gee, if Trevor's loss, what was it? Was it the opposition that he's put up against the mayor's proposal? You know,
well, he's done some annoying things that I think got some people in the district angry. The way he behaved toward some of his
Ozawa.
Opponents, Ozawa, yeah, that attempt to deal with the lit up tree.
And Waikai.
Yeah, and Waikai. These are the kinds of things, you know, city council races are nuts and bolts races. They're not very ideological. And I think there was enough there. And I think Natalie Iwasa, who is fairly popular in the district, she finished third, but she's well known and she worked actively for Tommy.
Yeah, she endorsed him.
Yeah, so all of those things made it a little closer than you would normally expect.
I wouldn't imagine, though, if I was Tommy Waters, I would want to recount again.
Well, but you can't get one. I mean, this is most states, and I think this is true for the city, too. Most states have an automatic recount if the percentage of votes are, if it's close enough, 1% or so. This state, there is no such thing. You have to petition the state Supreme Court and come up with reasons. And then the Supreme Court gets to decide. So it's by no means a done deal. And the fact of the matter is that the onus is on the challenger, not and the state makes it harder.
We only have a couple of minutes, but anything you want to say just about the state races?
I'm glad it's over. No, I will mention the Office of Hawaiian Affairs.
Yes.
Once again, very few people voted in those contests, even though it is a statewide race, even though non-Hawaiians can both run and vote in that. But you did see a big upset, or maybe something that was long time coming, the defeat of Rowena Akana, who has been in Oahu as a trustee longer than any of them, I think 28 years. And she finished fifth in a field of six people, three of those candidates going on to serve as trustees. It looks like it's Brendan Lee who bested William Ila. But I think that will augur some change. Kale Akaka defeating Esther Keaina, that's for Peter Apo's seat. Even though a lot of people don't pay attention to Oahu, it is an important state agency, quasi-agency, with Native Hawaiian beneficiaries as its mission. And that was a remarkable defeat for Akana, who, as we all know, is under State Ethics Commission investigation.
And the longest-serving trustee, 28 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
I think that the other thing that this showed is virtually the total destruction of the Republican Party in Hawaii. Now, you can point out a few little victories here. Tupolo is actually under better circumstances would be an attractive candidate, but it shows the structural limits to how you can recover. And there's a lot of ways you can go in that, and I'm not going to talk a whole lot about it, but one of the things that was most striking was not just that awful, very public battle between Tupola and Kearns, but the fact that nobody in the Republican Party of Hawaii has either the heft or the name recognition to step in. Yeah. If you think about how conflicts work in the Democratic Party, you know, you get into serious battles, and people say it's serious, and Ed Case has been through this before. There are, you can name a dozen Democrats who have the heft to step in and say there's a party unity issue here, let's work things out. The Republicans can't even do that. They don't even have a basic infrastructure.
They don't even have a bench.
No, they don't have a bench. No, no.
There's no Charles Issue. Right. There's no Linda Lingle.
No, no. And
Governor Lingle, where are you?
Yeah, well she's not coming back.
I mean, that was the best the Republicans had in years when she ran, and when DeJoux ran, they still got skunked. Yeah. Okay. And this is what happens when things get worse.
We would like to thank our guests, political analyst Neil Milner and Honolulu Civil Beats Chad Blair. And we'd also like to thank our Neighbor Island contributors, Sherry Bracken, Dick Mayer, and Jan Tinberg and Kate. And we would like to thank you, the listener, for joining us on today's show. If your call did not make it on the air during today's discussion, you can still contact the talkback line and leave your comments. What did you think about the election results? That number, 808-792-8217. You can also send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to today's show, check out the conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of the conversation.